cosmic storm. Floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight.
It's been 2 weeks, and well, it's time for a little bit of whimsical wavelengths on your Monday morning. I'm always learning new things and trying new things and, yes, making new episodes. This time, I got the opportunity to have a slightly different kind of guest. Well, maybe not that different. Not different at all. I mean, still a researcher, still talking about a paper they've recently published. The discipline, that's slightly different. We're going to look at education and STEM. At the people who choose science and technology bachelors. And more specifically, astronomy. Usually, we look outwards to the stars. But this week, we're turning the telescope around. The scientists are the ones under observation. Though, don't worry, it's all ethically approved. Understanding why people choose a specific career is an important thing for anyone with the eye to the future. Let me give you an example. In geoscience, i.e. my discipline, we've been feeling the tremors of change for a while. Low enrollment in universities, programs closing, and yet a massive cohort nearing retirement. There's also projected growth, but not enough space, or sometimes support, to train that next generation. So if a government or institution wanted to build that capacity, how would they do it? How would they attract new students? How would they make sure it is diverse and a resilient community, not just another rock cycle repeating itself? These questions aren't unique to geoscience. They ripple across all disciplines. Even in trades, we see efforts to reimagine how people see themselves in a role, how identity becomes part of that belonging. To reiterate, this episode is different because it flips the usual script. We're turning the scientist from the observer to the observed or the subject. And that's what I find fascinating about today's episode. It's a window into understanding who we are as scientists and how we identify with our chosen profession. For me, it started with volcanoes and the images and videos from Katya and Maurice Kraft, a fearless duo who chased eruptions all around the world with more enthusiasm than perhaps self-preservation. Their work delivered awe-inspiring footage. And probably inspired a few raised eyebrows at home when I said I wanted to study volcanoes too. It was also about encouragement from family to teachers and maybe even a touch of amused tolerance, if you will. During my undergrad at UVic, every single term paper I wrote in geoscience was some aspect of volcanism. But identity in science isn't just about passion or curiosity. It's shaped by mentorship, community, representation, and those subtle cues about who belongs. For students stepping into STEM, those early experiences, the classes they take, the people they see succeeding, the stories told about what it means to be a scientist, an astronomer, a geologist, a physicist, a biologist, they all influence whether they see themselves as part of that universe. And for those already in the field, identity evolves too. Especially when we become mentors, educators, collaborators, the next guiding stars for others. So to help us explore this topic, please welcome a researcher who started out with a Bachelor's of Science and a Master's of Science in Physics before, when doing his PhD, got it in science education. Currently a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History and a faculty member at the City University of New York, York College, Dr. Zachary Richards.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Before bringing up the paper, let's first turn the lens towards you. Started with a physics bachelor's of science, then you got a master's of science titled The Detection and Characterization of Extrasolar Planets. So I guess, what was that like? I mean, what was your personal evolution up to that point? In the words of one of my past physics professors, did the mathematics speak to you?
Yeah, so in high school, I was not much of a physics person to begin with. I got by the skin of my teeth. And when I went to college, I took an introductory astronomy class to fulfill a general education requirement. On the first night, I went to the observatory for extra credit, of course. I fell in love, you know, with astronomy. I was up at the observatory until 3 a.m., maybe, just hanging out with my professor. And, you know, looking at the stars, between that and the way that he taught, it was very animated and very engaging. It was that kind of a moment where I started to think that I really wanted to do, you know, astrophysics. And at the end of the semester, I asked my professor, how do I do what you do? And he said, you need to major in physics, to which at that time I said, well, shoot.
Yeah. Oh, dear bleep.
Yeah. And so right after that, I went down to my advisor and I said, I'm going to major in physics. And that's kind of the short story. And so I spent a lot of time doing outreach with the observatory after that. I really wanted to teach at the college level and, you know, become a professor. So that was that portion.
So I guess it was more of pushing the boundaries of what we know or exploring the unknown, like Star Trek would say, instead of letting the math as a language write the cosmos. Because there's definitely multiple ways to get into physics and astrophysics, and mm-hmm. I'm sure we're going to get into that in a moment. But I guess that's kind of the tact, you could say.
Yeah, yeah. It was more just pure wonder. What's out there? You know, this. It was a completely new world to me, and I fell in love with it.
It's fair. I mean, any of us who have gotten a PhD in sciences have things along our journey that kind of take us there for sure. But then you shifted from just pure research, discovering the cosmos, to science education. So how did that all come about?
Yeah. So after I received my master's degree, so I'm originally from New York City, and I moved back to New York City. And I was a little bit, burnt out. And I needed a job. At that time, the only thing that really I saw myself doing was teaching. And so I got a job as an adjunct instructor, teaching astronomy as well as like a life in the universe course and physics. And I started teaching. And through that time, I met my supervisor, now colleague and friend, Ali. And teaching kind of reinvigorated me to want to go back and, you know, actually get my PhD in astrophysics, because that was the goal the whole time. However, living in New York and needing to make money, you know, most of my time was spent teaching, and I also made ice cream on the side.
Ice cream on the side?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you happen to listen to earlier episode of this season where we did ice cream science too?
No, I did not. But that's a really funny coincidence. So I was basically an ice cream chef while I adjuncted. You know, the days that I wasn't teaching, I was, you know, making ice cream. And I started to apply to graduate schools again, and I kept on getting rejected. And the feedback that I was getting was I was not doing enough research in my own time. And I was too focused on teaching. And by the end of it, I think I applied four times where everybody said, you're teaching too much and not doing enough research. I could not do research, that much research for free. You know,
for
I did
sure.
A little bit. But because I was teaching a lot and I had many conversations about this, on the fourth time around, it was recommended that since I really just wanted to teach at the time, I should maybe consider going for a PhD in science education. And at the time, I begrudgingly considered the idea because it wasn't what I wanted to do initially, right? But over time, I came to terms with it, and then I applied, and I got in. So I went. Because I've always wanted to teach, right? When I thought of professor, the real thing that I was interested in was teaching.
Is that partly because that professor that got you into all of this made such an impact on your life? You're like, that's kind of the impact that I want to make?
That's a big part of it, yeah. But also, when I look back, education is a world that I know really well because my mother was a teacher and her father was also a teacher.
Oh, so it runs in the family.
Yeah. and so I really knew education well. And it's actually been a really lovely lesson about life has a way of working out for you.
As long as you're willing to go for it. Yeah. As long as you're willing to go for it, life has a tendency to work out for you.
Yeah. It just maybe slightly different than the way you envisioned. And so now I'm doing a lot of research in astronomy education. What we'll talk about later is, you know, how students start to build an identity as an astronomer. I'm also doing work on how can we detect students at risk of failing their astronomy classes, specifically their introductory classes, so that we can implement, you know, some sort of strategy for them, an intervention, so that they can pass their course. Specifically because introductory astronomy classes are usually the only science class a regular student will take.
We have words for those courses sometimes in jokes, I should say, in the different universities I've had. Like, yeah. Rocks for jocks, death and dinos, moons for goons.
Yeah, I don't know if we have, or at least I don't know of any of those for astronomy. But, you know, a lot of people are genuinely interested in astronomy. And, you know, if we can have more positive experiences, maybe we can have more individuals, you know, switch to some sort of STEM major. Yeah, and I'm also now, you know, starting to make my way back towards exoplanets. So, you know, things kind of
can go for a circle, for sure.
Yeah, you deviate from the path a little bit, and then you find your way.
Okay, well, that really brings us neatly, because you've already mentioned it, to the paper at hand, and then what were the main topic of today, Astronomy Identity Framework for Undergraduate Students and Researchers. And there's no better place to start than the first phrase I came across that I had no idea what it meant. And it's also one of my fun things that I like to do on the podcast, which tells you I'm really nerdy. The first sentence of the abstract had this phrase, transcendental phenomenological. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what that meant. I spent probably an hour trying to figure it out, and I kind of came to, I think, the right answer, but it's way outside my field. So can you break it down?
Sure, yeah. So this paper, you know, as doing research in doing in science education, research can be broken down into two parts, the quantitative section, which is where I thrive, and then there's the qualitative aspect. In this particular scenario, qualitative means interviewing participants or, you know, basically having a conversation with them. And so one of the approaches to qualitative research is phenomenology, in which is what you essentially do, to break it down in like 50 words or less. You interview up to about 15 or so people who all have experienced the same event, right, or the same phenomenon. So in this case, the paper was about, you know, individuals majoring in astronomy or doing research in astronomy. So that was the phenomena that we were examining.
So phenomenological is just the process of taking verbal or interview or writing and then breaking it down into its individual word parts.
Yeah, exactly. So we start with people, you know, having the same experience. In this study, the data itself were the recordings or the transcripts of our interviews. And from there, we take the transcripts and we break it down into specific quotes. And, you know, and these quotes basically act as little nuggets of information that we can analyze.
All right, what's the other word then? How does that modify it? Transcendental.
Yeah, so it's just the specific kind of phenomenology, but they all essentially focus on just gathering people with a shared experience.
I ask these questions because it's always important for people trying to understand peer-reviewed papers. Like, how do we get the data? Like, so understanding where the science and the data comes from is really important. Okay, so I think the next step for everyone following along is the word identity. And what that really means, and let's try to broaden it out for science more in general, and then we'll get more into the paper. So, like, like we have our own personal identity and who we think we are, what we wear, what we eat, and our beliefs. But what does it mean in this context?
Yeah. So, in the terms of the research, identity is how one sees themselves as a specific person. So, for example, for this paper, right? Well, just to stick with it, right? Identity, we're looking at how individuals see themselves as like an astronomy person. How do they see themselves as an astronomer?
Okay. But I mean, are there like different identities in different scientific disciplines? I'm going to be really silly here and just lean on my Bachelor of Science here when I knew nothing about the world. I still don't, but I pretend I do for this podcast. So in geology students, they knew how to party. Like, they just, I mean, their pub crawls were legendary and a good time. Physics, we went to the brewery, we skipped the tour and just drank as much beer as we possibly could in the paid hour and then went home. The engineers, they did engineering things? Okay. Well, it's a poor showing, but it shows the stereotypes for a university I went to, which is kind of like an identity, or at least a perceived one anyway. Do factors like that pop out in analysis like this? Do people who have the mathematics speak to them have different qualities than those that are like looking for exploring the unknown?
Yeah. So in the paper itself, we've put together a framework which tells us, or you know, what certain things lead to somebody seeing themselves. And in total, we actually have six different parts, and they are broken up into internal influences and external influences. And on the external influences side, one of those parts is actually socializing.
So the pub crawls, the brewery tours, the random pranks engineers pull, like putting cars on top of buildings or whatever the heck they do.
Yeah, but the informal parts of socializing were not necessarily, did not really come out in this
study. Fair.
But you know, one could take a guess that that does play a part. But the socializing, that informal socializing definitely played a part. Details were not explored about that part. However, you know, socializing with peers and with other faculty members definitely plays a role, because socializing, one, allows you to see that whatever struggles you're having, you may not necessarily be alone. And that's something that actually did come out with our participants. And so, you know, that helps. But also, you know, talking to professors, like say, or other faculty members, this allows you, you know, to see what it's like to be an astronomer, which can lead to career expectations, which is also part of the framework. And you can also get recognition from faculty members as well, which are all the other two of the external parts. So that would be career expectations. So, you know, what do you expect, you know, your career or future to be like, you know, as an astronomer? Do you see yourself doing these tasks? And recognition is, you know, getting recognized as the astronomy person, let's say, right? And this, for example, in an informal recognition. And that would be your family and friends, you know, thinking you are the astronomy person, and anytime, you know, there's something on the news, they go and ask you, right, about it. And then, you know, there's a formal recognition, you know, being recognized, you know, getting recognition, let's say, from doing a good job on your research project, right, from other peers and faculty members. And so between career expectations, recognition, and socializing, that's the external part. And then the internal part is being interested in astronomy, competence. So, you know, do you think you can do the work of an astronomer? And a sense of belonging within the astronomical community as a whole. And those are the six components. What we see is, at least for getting interested in astronomy, some people become interested in their general education classes. One participant noted that they had no idea that they could get a job in astronomy until they took their intro astronomy course at a community college. But what we also see is that people become interested in astronomy usually at young ages, because there's some connection, a familial connection. Maybe one of their parents took them out and showed them you know, some of the constellations. And what's great about astronomy is that, unlike most sciences, you don't really need any equipment to do it. All you need to do is look up. So it's really accessible.
For sure. I have a couple more questions that I'm going to try to remember to get back round to as we get a little further in. But I think it's kind of important to jump into some of the more technical parts of the paper. So this paper focused on marginalized communities in astronomy. So by focusing on this subset of people, what was your broader goal?
Well, so it was not intentional.
Wait.
Yeah. Yeah, it was not the initial intent to study individuals who came from an underrepresented group. So the way, you know, we recruited, by reaching out to physics and astronomy majors from two universities in New York State, and I cannot say which ones, I need to protect identities and all that jazz. And so this was open to anybody of any gender, any ethnic group. It just so happened the individuals who responded and wanted to participate in the study all happened to be from one of the underrepresented groups.
Just so by coincidence. I think you would call that self-selection bias, kind of? The people are choosing to volunteer, and they're choosing to volunteer from underrepresented groups. And I'm wondering what that says about the process in and of itself. I'm pretty sure this takes it beyond the paper because this wasn't really talked about. But the fact that underrepresented groups were more likely to reach out, even though there's less of them, than the well-represented, like I would represent a well-represented group. why the disparity there? I know this goes beyond your paper, but the questions come up. So are you willing to opine on it?
Yeah, so I guess maybe you were going to ask this later,
Go for it.
Yeah. So one way that studying identity, one of its implications is, one, it helps understand how people start to see themselves as astronomers, or, you know, how do they feel like they belong, for example, right? It can help develop or guide, policy changes to make departments or the community more diverse, more inclusive. And I think these individuals, they've had negative experiences and nothing has been done about their experiences. So telling their story, right, can help get it out there. And we can use that to help change the policies and, you know, make everything more welcoming, more inclusive, more diverse.
For sure. And I didn't put this in my show notes to give to you because I wasn't sure I was going to bring it up, but you've kind of touched on it right here, is that I think when I was reading the paper, I read one line that a professor at one point told a young woman, like, don't bother with physics because you're a woman. And I was just read that and I went, oh boy. Like,
yes.
Wow. Like, me as an adult today, not the 20-year-old in school, would very much instantaneously turn around and complain about this person to the highest echelons of a department. I don't know if I would have when I was 20, but, you know, with age comes wisdom. So that's kind of what you're saying by negative experiences, that they feel one of the best ways is through engaging something like this in the hopes that their story can be told and things can be changed.
Yeah, that is definitely one.
It's speechless. It's hard to even say anything about, because you're just like, holy smokes. Like, I thought this isn't, what, you know, pick an age in the past. Like, we're, come on.
Yeah, there's, surprisingly, there's still a lot of gender and racial bias that goes on, you know, and sometimes it's just ignored.
Yeah, I have my own, I don't want to call it a background, but experiences, because I was part of the teaching support staff union at my university. So we would get a lot of the dirt that was coming through the university of things like this. And again, it's all on, you know, backstory of you're not allowed to really talk about it because it's these personal things, right? So yes, for the listener, these things really do happen. And being able to bring these to light in ways that keep people protected and perhaps change policy is really, really important to the, like, the health of our individual disciplines as well, for sure. That was kind of an unplanned dark turn, but I think that's part of what the research is really all about and why this paper or research avenues are really important.
Yeah, the sciences, you know, we need a change, maybe a first step or continuing step, you know, in order to help make astronomy, as you know, more inclusive, you know, more comfortable for people of different backgrounds, maybe even extends past astronomy and into other sciences.
Yeah, for sure. This is not an astronomy only problem, I guess. Just to kind of move on a little bit, I recognize this study is qualitative, so descriptive in its nature, but I also noticed that the sample size is quite small. I have no idea what a large sample size would be for a study like this. So is this a small, medium, large?
Yeah, so literature suggests for a study like this, a sample size will be between 10 and 15 individuals. So it is Right on target. Usually with qualitative studies, the sample size is much lower than any sort of quantitative study. In quantitative, you can have thousands, hundreds of thousands of data points, but it's really difficult to, I cannot stress this enough, how difficult it can be to actually recruit people for a study. And there are definitely studies out there that have 30 people, let's say, that they've interviewed, which is quite high. And the issue really is getting people to commit to it. Because you can have an email exchange with somebody who has agreed to be interviewed and they decide to cancel or decide not to show up. And, that's kind of that's part of it. So usually double digits is pretty good.
Fair. So we've already mentioned, just to reiterate off the top, that the data is just so that we don't lose it in the churn of everything. Because this was my next question, but we've already covered it. The data is collected by having these interviews, recording those interviews, and then analyzing that. But playing with data sets that are not just numbers, how do you achieve a standardization? I mean, look at how effective drugs are. You would do like a double-blind study with the real thing and a placebo. In some sciences, they use statistical measures. So how do you determine or talk about what is actually, really important out of this data set?
So the way that I'll start with how we analyze the transcripts. So we use something called open coding, which basically means we don't know what we're going to find. And as we go through the transcripts, we are going to make up our codes. For example, an example of a code would be showing interest in astronomy. For example. And so we do that, and we look at all the different possible codes of that can come up, and then we go back and we refine those codes. And then what we did was axial coding. So what we did was we looked at what the codes were saying, and we looked at if they were having a positive, negative, or neutral effect. So for example, going back to the participant you mentioned before. Right, that was coded as faculty interaction, which would have, and then it was coded
Negative.
as negative.
Right. Well, obviously.
Right. And then we go back and we refine this again to break it up into overall themes. So that's the very general way that we go about analyzing the transcripts. And so how do we now to actually answer your question? So they're analyzed separately by in our case, there's two of us. So they were analyzed separately, and then we would come back and have discussions about the open codes, the axial codes, the themes, right? And we would see where we would agree and disagree, and then we would go back, do it again, and come back and discuss what was different, why was it different. Until coded everything, the whole idea is to get an inter-rater reliability score of 90% or higher. And so we did that until, we hit the score of 90. I forget what the exact number,
It doesn't matter. Question though, you said this is an iterative process. So I guess there's two parts to this. First off, the simple one, was there ever a time where you guys were within the threshold immediately and you didn't have to repeat it?
That would have been the last one. Yeah.
So,
So it took us, I think, about maybe 6 or 8 times.
okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And part of what you just described is also part of the explanation, I think, for the next question. Is dealing with bias because you have two people here and how do you remove a personal bias from it? There must be a little bit more to it than just two people doing it separately.
Yeah, I mean, it can be up to, there could be more people involved. Just
Like,
this.
was one of the people doing the analysis also doing the interviewing?
Yeah, we both interviewed as well.
Okay.
Not to make it overly biased. So usually in these kinds of in qualitative work, let's say, the authors explicitly state what their biases are. So we have a section in the paper stating what our biases are, right? Did we, you know, what subjects do we teach, right? For example, because that can have an effect on how
I read that. To be fair, yeah. I read that and was kind of confused why that was there. Now I know.
Yeah, you know, or did we, you know, did we happen to know any of them beforehand, right? For example, as a way to be clear and transparent about the biases and how they play into the research, right? So if you read the paper, you'll see where our biases, what their biases are and how they kind of play into how the research was conducted. But the important thing is to be very explicit and state your biases, which would make you, you know, you have to be very honest with yourself and, you know, and very self-aware of the thing, the decisions you make while interviewing.
For sure. I guess this is another question.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going down a rabbit hole. Knowing oneself sometimes is not something academics are particularly good at. So how often does that not get done properly in your field?
That's an excellent question. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure. So within the field of astronomy education research itself, there's not much qualitative work that's compared to the amount of quantitative work, because most of the time, the individuals performing their research are trained astronomers who have gained some interest in, you know, in the education side, and so they are trained astronomers first. And,
right, so they're using the mathematics to speak for them, and you're trying to let the words speak.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
So, the transcripts and everything that you put together into this paper, what's the takeaway home message out of it all? And I guess kind of tangentially as a touchy-feely type sort of thing, like how did doing this research make you feel about astronomy writ large in your neighborhood?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of things that hit home. I did find that there were a lot of similarities with myself in what everybody was talking about, you know, specifically with how they got interested in astronomy, right? One participant made mention of their introductory astronomy course. Right? You know, that was me. Participants, right? Also made mention of, you know, looking up or having a family member show them something of the night sky. You know, when I was a kid, for example, my father used to show me the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper, or, you know, just looking up. And astronomy is great, right, because it's the most accessible. All you need to do is just, you know, look up. It's there. So, yeah, I did find a lot of similarities, and it definitely inspired me to continue doing this kind of, you know, pursuing this area so that we can make changes and also get, for me specifically, get back out to doing outreach. Because a lot of the time, most of the times people interact, the way that people interact with astronomy is not formal.
Yeah.
It's not really part of any educational curriculum. You know, it's usually lumped in with earth sciences, let's say. So most of the people interact with it in an informal environment. And if we want to start to recruit more individuals, right, or we want to be able to make to diversify, we need to start doing more outreach to get people excited about astronomy and then to bring them in. Because sometimes it's just it's a little bit hard in once you're in college, you know, a multitude of reasons.
So in other words, getting to the people before they get to college, like your high schoolers or even elementary school, right? Like get them thinking that this is even a possibility before they get to that stage.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be nice to have it known that they can actually pursue this. And if we can get the parents on board, you know, through informal outreach events, let's say, right, have them doing stuff with their children.
It's almost like you need a museum that you work at to really be able to do something like this.
Almost. Yeah.
So that's a segue. It's like, okay, the future, where does this go? Like, can you use the museum to help get this goal moving in some respects?
Yeah. So this focused on like undergraduates. We can definitely use the museum and expand on this. I do have ideas. I don't want to necessarily get scooped.
It's funny how that works. Like, it's always a problem when you have a whole bunch of other people and you know you have a pretty good story and you want to talk about it, but you're like, oh, if I talk about it too loudly and I'm not quite ready to put pen to paper, I'm potentially sabotaging my own work. It's rough because science is built on this ability to share results, but the reality of it is that you also want to be able to take these ideas to its as far as you can. It's a tricky thing for sure.
Most
Yeah.
definitely.
I think people under appreciate that when you're not in sciences and
But the research can definitely be expanded. It doesn't necessarily have to always be qualitative. Right, there's a way to do this quantitatively
Yeah, is that
as
going to
well.
be kind of your next step is to broaden this into quantitative spheres?
Yeah, that's currently working on that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we've covered everything, and we're almost to the traditional last question time. Feared and celebrated last question. But before we do that, is there anything you want to call out or make mention of? I don't know. Anything at all, future work, past work, colleagues, anything?
Oh, sure. Look, I could definitely not have been where I am now without my family. My parents, specifically, they've done more than they can ever know, and I can't necessarily put that into words, you know. Also, definitely want to thank my friend and colleague Allie, because she was, kind of the one who really got me to move this way. None of this would have been possible without her, either. And also, my PhD advisor, Angela. So this was actually part of my dissertation. Yeah, Angela is an amazing advisor. 12 out of 10. Absolutely fantastic. She's great.
Awesome. Okay. So now for the traditional last question. Tell us your favorite science joke.
Okay, my favorite science joke. So, what did the sun say when the moon leaned in to kiss it?
Don't
Eek! Lips.
Oh, these are so great. Some of them, they're so terrible, they're awesome. And some of them are so awesome, they're terrible.
Yes. It always takes people. Look, I tell this to my students all the time. And they're
Hopefully,
just
you
like, I
get
don't
more
get it.
laughter than I ever got. Every time I told a joke in front of 300 people, you could hear a pin drop. Until I say, it was like, oh, come on, guys, I know it was bad, but was it really that bad? And then everybody would start laughing, and I never understood that.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
All right, well, thanks for being on. And
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
check out the show notes for the access to the paper and the museum and everything else. So, I'll see you guys again in 2 weeks. This is the normal time of the show. And I say, if you haven't already done so, subscribe, leave a rating, poke me on social media. In fact, just hopefully, I may have gotten a really cool guest that'll come on in the new year from social media interaction. Amazing. And next one is a Christmas special of sorts, but don't worry, it's not actually about Christmas. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
In a world so chaotic, so misbehaved, echoes of melodies remind us it's always colors weave stories painting the sky, swaying to rhythms as the galaxies fly by. Chasing down